Well, today's message is something that I have been talking about and praying about sharing for over a year now. Matter of fact, when pastors sit down together in our staff meeting, sometimes we coordinate, you know, what are some of the messages that we think are important for the church family to hear in the course of a year? Well, we talk about prayer, and we talk about the importance of personal devotions. And then one of the most important things we know that every church family needs to hear is a good message or two on the subject of marriage. But then as the pastors look at each other, we say, I say, Jean, why don't you do it? And Jean will look at Pastor Quitzevite and say, John, why don't you do it? And just, I'll say, Doug, you're the senior pastor. You do it. I said, but my name's Bachelor. I said, you guys do it. I said, and we thought Danny ought to do it until he went and got married. But, you know, nobody feels like that they can perfectly talk about one of the most sacred relationships that is really under attack. And it's the subject of marriage, but it's something the Bible has a lot to say about, and we think it's important. And so you pray for me as I share with you our message for today, and it's going to be maybe a 2 or 3 part message, is going to be called Together for Life. Together for Life, Bible Keys for a Happy Marriage. And marriage is the foundational institution for the nation and for society. It's typically how people come into the world. It's how nations are born. It's where the first teaching transpires. It forms you as a person. Marriage is very important. People put a lot of emphasis on, you know, having extravagant weddings and doing unique or sometimes even zany things in their wedding. But in all of that, maybe it loses its sacredness. Much of the world tuned in 2011 for the globally broadcast wedding of Prince William and Kate Middleton. It was a prince's wedding. And they say that it cost $34 million. Wedding cake, $80,000. $800,000 in flowers for the wedding. But those of you who remember, back in 1981, it was actually the marriage of William's mother and Prince Charles that was called the wedding of the century. You know, Di's dress was only $13,000, but that was back then, that was a lot more money. Matter of fact, if you adjust for inflation, their wedding today would have cost $70 million. And that was mostly for crowd control and security. Really, that's where most of it went. You know, it was sort of that fairy tale story about the prince marrying the daughter of a commoner. And it's interesting that Princess Di herself, her parents had divorced. When she was very young, one day her mother told her, she said, I'll be home soon, and she never came home. And it really troubled her for many years after that. When Prince Charles began to date Di's sister, she told her friend, she said, I'm going to marry that man. And they said, what makes you so sure? She says, I've got to marry him because he's the only man in the world that is not allowed to divorce me. And then those of you who remember the story, it unraveled for all the world to watch with evidently unfaithfulness on both sides, ended in divorce, and ultimately a tragic death. In our world today, divorce is epidemic. You've probably heard the statistics that somewhere between 40 and 50% of marriages end in divorce. The reason those statistics are so sloppy is because so many people live today without even the benefit of marriage, it's hard to really measure it. I believe it was, someone thinks maybe, well, maybe the second marriage will be better. 60% of second marriages end in divorce, and it's even worse for third marriages. Paige Patterson, who was the president of the Baptist Theological Seminary in Fort Worth, citing the demise of 21 of the world's great civilizations. Actually, the historian who wrote about this was an atheist, but he said that he discovered that among the 21 of the world's greatest civilizations, part of their breakdown was the breakdown of the home. Adding to that, he said, America could be living out its final chapters in the annals of history unless the biblical model for the family is restored. James Dobson said in May of this year, I do not recall a time when the institutions of marriage and the family have faced such peril, or when the forces arrayed against them were more formidable or determined. Barring a miracle, the family that has existed since antiquity will likely crumble, foreshadowing the fall of Western civilization itself. And many are wondering if what happened with the Supreme Court at that recent ruling on marriage was driving a silver spike in the heart of American marriage altogether. Well, what do we do? We throw our hands in the air and say, well, I guess that's the end of marriage. There was a Pew survey that went out, I believe, last year, and an increasing number, was it 40% of Americans felt marriage may be becoming irrelevant. This institution that is the bedrock foundation of our culture. Well, you know, the Bible says that marriage is God's plan. If you read the Bible, it begins with a wedding. And God officiates at the first wedding between Adam and Eve. The Bible ends with the wedding supper of the Lamb. The first miracle of Jesus is performed at a wedding. A marriage was very important to the Lord. Read the Song of Solomon and so many of the other stories, whether it's Hosea or a number of others, they're done, the parables of Jesus are often in the context of a wedding. Marriage is a very important truth to God, and it is, as I said, it's a foundational, it is the single most important basic unit in our lives and culture. You know, marriage, reproduction, is one of the greatest mysteries that evolutionists cannot explain. It's a miracle because if all life on earth began by single-cell organisms somehow teaching themselves to divide and retain all of the DNA in their two separate parts, what would ever in the evolutionary scheme of things explain why organisms could not procreate and reproduce without the cooperation of the opposite sex? It doesn't make sense. There's nothing in evolution that would ever say, let's do it this way, because it seems inefficient. I mean, when you want to start a family, if you're a single cell, just split and there you go, right? But to have to get along with and court and make friends with another cell of an opposite gender so that you could cooperate and reproduce, nothing in evolution can explain that. But God has designed that He made them male and female, and through the two of them, the differences between men and women, we collectively express the image of God. There are aspects of the image of God that are seen in the woman and the mother, and there are aspects of the image of God that are seen in the man and the father, and it is not really complete until you see them both together. They become one through marriage. The Lord said, Genesis chapter 2, verse 18, it is not good that man should be alone. Now I know whenever I talk about a message like this, there's always a lot of singles that are here, some who have never been married, some who have been married, maybe divorced, maybe widowed. And you're thinking, how do I fit into all of this? Well, bear with me, and in the following presentations, we're going to be talking about that in relation to family. But God said it's not good for man to be alone. That's not just talking about marriage, but man is designed to be a social creature. And you can take from me, I lived as a hermit for a long time. And I always like to say that there's probably not too many people that are here today or listening that can say that you've gone days or weeks without seeing another human face, hearing another human voice, no radio, no human contact, no guards coming by to bring you a meal. You're just all by yourself. And I can tell you, it's not good for a man to be alone. I just did it because I had trouble getting along, but being alone is worse. And the Lord finally taught me, you can't run away from people all the time. You've got to learn to get along. And you know, that's part of the reason of marriage, is that the Lord puts you together with a person, and the very things that you find so attractive about them are things that you usually don't possess. And it's almost opposite sometimes. And God has a sense of humor. Opposites attract. And those very things that you like so much because they're different end up becoming annoying later. And they become the catalyst for sanctifying you. That's right. And the Lord smiles from the heavens and says, if you love me, love them. It's not good for man to be alone. Some of you remember reading, or you heard about, the story of Robinson Crusoe. Robinson Crusoe, believe it or not, is actually based on the true story of a sailor by the name of Alexander Selkirk, who got into a very severe argument. He had trouble getting along. And he got into a severe argument with the captain, Dampierre, who put him off on an island when they stopped. He said, I'd rather live by myself, and the next ship will pick me up. They put him off on an island off of Chile called San Fernando, hundreds of miles out in the ocean, and left him there. Well, it was years before another ship came by. And there's nothing on the island but some cats that escaped and multiplied, and some goats and rats. And he was extremely lonely. But he eventually sort of learned to get along and made friends with the goats and learned how to survive. And when they finally found him and they rescued him, another ship came by. They said they had a hard time talking to him because he had not communicated with people in so long that his sentences were sort of short, muttering, and garbled. Matter of fact, I think it was Robert Louis Stevenson, in his book Treasure Island, he talks about a hermit that was found. He based some of that on the way that Alexander Selkirk communicated. Through the lack of social context, he became eccentric. And when we live unto ourselves, we become emotionally and socially unhealthy. It is not good that a man should be alone. Marriage is part of God's plan for men and women. Now, sometimes it's, I think, harder for men. And a 9-year-old girl said that's because men need someone to clean up after them. But it's part of God's plan. Now, there's a number of books that'll tell you about this, and so probably what I'm going to say is nothing new. Some people talk about men being from Mars and women being from Venus, and there's another number of other scenarios about how men and women are so uniquely different. Chuck Swindoll, in a book called The Great Awakening, he reveals a survey that was done among thousands of men and women about what they expressed as their five major needs. Now listen to what the five major needs of a woman, what she is looking for in a relationship. 1, affection. 2, conversation. 3, honesty and openness. 4, financial support. 5, family commitment. The five major needs expressed by men. Sexual fulfillment, 1. Recreational companionship, an attractive spouse, domestic support, whatever that means, admiration and respect. Now, when you look at the needs and expectations coming into a marriage, can you see just from the surveys of the generalities of what men are looking for and what women are looking for, that there's potential for problems? Because there are extremely different needs and expectations coming into these relationships. Now, I don't want to dwell too much about this, but it's something that we probably are going to have to talk about. What are the main reasons that divorce happens? I'm just going to give you 24 of the top reasons that are listed when people cite the reasons for divorce. Financial problems. You know, a lot of people, they think, well, before we get married, we should live together so we get to know each other to find out if we're compatible. Have you heard that one before? Why, you guys aren't married. Why are you living together? Well, we want to make sure we're compatible before we, you know, make it official. And I heard a pastor say, if you want to find out if you're compatible, you don't need to share a bed. Share a checkbook. Because the number one reason that people get divorced is not because they are sexually incompatible, it's they're financially incompatible. Financial problems, number one. Inability to manage or resolve conflict. Infidelity. Cultural and lifestyle differences. And that sometimes is bigger than you think. People, they grow up in a whole different culture with different expectations and different patterns and traditions that can seem so bizarre to people from a different culture. A lack of commitment is put down. Lack of communication between spouses. Abandonment. Alcohol or drug addiction. Physical abuse. Emotional abuse. Personality differences or irreconcilable differences. Have you heard that before? Differences in personal or career goals. Different expectations about household tasks. Get divorced because she thought he was going to do it and he thought she was going to do it. Different expectations about having or rearing children. That's a big one. Interference from parents or in-laws. Lack of maturity is listed as a difference. Intellectual incompatibility, sometimes just the educational level, can become a problem. Sexual incompatibility is listed, but it's pretty far down the list. Not allowing room for personal growth, falling out of love, almost sounds like somebody left the lid off the septic tank and someone fell in love and then they somehow fell out also. You fall out of love. It's like falling up. Religious conversion or religious beliefs, I've seen that become a serious issue. Mental instability or mental illness. Criminal behavior and incarceration for crime. It's very hard on marriages when one spouse is incarcerated for a long period of time. Inability to deal with each other's petty idiosyncrasies. Now, you might find that some of these are issues in your marriages, those of you who are married here. But none of them needs to be the reason for divorce. And I'm going to go through a list of maybe 18 different subjects that are Bible secrets. And if we understand these things, they can really contribute to healing a marriage and making a good marriage better if we follow these principles. First of all, number one, remember that marriage is a divine covenant. It is something that is very serious. We are saved. You're in church today because ostensibly you want to be or are a Christian, and we are saved based on a covenant, a promise that God has made to us. He gave His Son to save us, and we by faith accept His word, and we make a pledge that we give our lives to Him. That's what happened today with these baptisms. A covenant is made. Covenants, agreements, promises, very important. Marriage is among the most important covenants or promises that are made. You're making vows in the presence of God and other witnesses. It's a covenant that's not only something that is done before you and God, it's something that is done socially. And I should probably pause here and say, and I know I'm going to get letters on this, people say, well, you know, we're married in the eyes of God, but we're not interested in the government's part in our marriage. And so, no, we haven't been married with a license, but we believe we're married and we do it before God. And is it necessary to go through the ceremony and get registered with the state? And when I was a young hippie, I would have argued that one way. But as I've gotten a little older and more practical and I read the Bible, I don't agree with that. I think it does matter that you are legally married. By the way, I've asked couples before, they said, well, we're married in the eyes of God. I said, well, where are you legally married? And they said, well, no, but we're married. I said, well, then if you're not legally married, all that's left is you're illegally married. And I said, marriage is not just between the two of you and God. Marriage is also something that is a statement you make publicly, socially. It's a commitment, a covenant that makes for one thing. It is saying publicly, we are officially committing ourselves to each other. She is off the market for anyone else that might be interested. She's saying he is off the market. We are a new family unit that is to be guarded and respected by the culture and society. It is a public commitment. And it used to be that the reason the government was involved is because there was offspring that was the product of those unions. And if one of the spouses died or both spouses died, they needed to determine how to deal with the children. And then sometimes the government would have to step in to care for those things, and there were laws involved. But it does matter that you are legally married. Is it required that you are married in a church? No, it doesn't say so in the Bible. But I think if you're a Christian, you would want it to be a religious service because it's a covenant in the presence of God, and you want to commit your lives to God. Jesus said, Matthew 19, verse 5, "For this cause a man will leave his father and his mother and cleave unto his wife, wherefore they are no more two, but one flesh. Wherefore what God has joined together, let not man put asunder." And the disciples came to Jesus and they said, "Well, Moses, he gave us a law about divorce and how we accomplish a divorce, and you're teaching something different." Jesus said, "Yes, because of the hardness of your hearts, Moses made those laws." They actually had a law that by the time of Christ, a man could divorce his wife if she burned his food. I mean, they kept expanding what the excuses for divorce were because of the hardness of hearts. And God says, "I hate divorce." And that translates about the same in any version of the Bible that you have. Now, I know that a lot of people here are affected by this, and I need to let you know there are times when biblically it is appropriate to divorce. As much as God hates divorce, it was God who told Abraham to divorce, put away Hagar. Of course, he had one wife too many at the time. He had to deal with that. But look at all the heartache that it brought. It's never God's plan. Now, there's some people that it seems like they like Moses' law better than Jesus. But Jesus said that we should love each other. The devil is a notorious homebreaker. You might be thinking, "Oh boy, this gal, this man, they are so impossible. The things that I have to live with, their habits, their idiosyncrasies, driving me crazy." Think of yourself as a missionary if you're a Christian. I've heard stories of missionaries that go into some foreign land and they learn to care for, love, clean pagans with leprosy. And you think, if they can do that, then can you love your spouse? We often are being influenced by the media and the ideas of what love and marriage is supposed to be. A lot of it is sort of fantastic. And it makes everyone think, "Well, I don't have it perfect, and so we're unhappy." Well, don't fall for that line of what marriage is. It's supposed to be a covenant. Some of you remember the expression, cutting the Gordian knot. You ever heard that expression before? Cutting the Gordian knot. Maybe you haven't. Well, it goes back to history that it's supposed to be based in some truth, that there was this king of Gordian, and he was miraculously, a prophet said, whoever comes into town, he's going to be the king. And his first guy came into town with his wagon, and all the people hailed him as king and carried him on their shoulders. And he thought that it was somehow the wagon was good luck that day. And so he brought the wagon into the temple, and he had them secure the hitch of the wagon through the eye hole to this altar with this great big intricate knot of a big thick rope. And he said, "When I die, whoever can untie this knot, he is the next king." Well, he died, and 100 years went by, and nobody could untie the knot until a young Macedonian king came into town. His name was Alexander the Great. He had heard the legend. He saw the wagon and the knot. He tried to untie it for a few minutes, and he realized that it was too big and too hard and too stiff, and he couldn't do it. So he took out his sharp sword, and with one whack, the thing frayed apart, and he cut it. He says, "I have untied the knot." And when you quickly resolve a difficult problem, it's called cutting the Gordian knot. Now, any of you remember that story? A few of you. Did any of you take world history? And marriage knot should never be untied. And when you make that covenant, when you make that commitment, you want it to be firm and sealed. It is dangerous to go into marriage thinking that divorce is an option, because if you in the back of your mind even think it, then you can end up having problems. Some people look at divorce as an escape hatch. I'd like to recommend, if you're a Christian, shut the hatch, weld it, lock it, throw away the key. Amen. As soon as you know it's not an option, and you realize that you're on a deserted island with this person called your husband or your wife, you got to get along. then you start doing your best to make the best of it. Now, again, I recognize there are some even biblical grounds for divorce. Do you know what they are? There are two reasons that are really given in the Bible when it's appropriate to divorce, and not just divorce, because you can separate. You know, if there's abuse in the marriage, you should separate. But to divorce, often people are thinking divorce is designed to put them back on the market so they can remarry. One is for the cause of fornication, Jesus said. If one spouse or the other violates those sacred vows and commits that intimate act with another person, they biblically have grounds. They have broken the covenant. They have grounds to divorce and then to remarry. It doesn't mean they have to. Nowhere is Jesus saying that you have to divorce. Reconciliation is always much better. And let me ask you, does the Bible sometimes use the expression that the Lord is our husband, the church is the bride? Does God say that sometimes his people, whether it was Israel or the church, has played the harlot and committed adultery? Does the Lord forgive? Read the book of Hosea and take her back? If there has been infidelity, it doesn't mean you have to get divorced. And I told you there are two reasons. In 1 Corinthians chapter 7, another example is given. And Paul is talking to pagans. There's people out there, they worship the Greco-Roman array of gods. And one of them accepts Jesus. Let's suppose the wife then accepts Jesus. And the husband says, I didn't sign up for this. I don't want to be a Christian. I don't want to follow your laws. I'm leaving. If that husband abandons the wife because she has accepted Jesus, they both got married as pagans, then Paul says she is free in that regard. Let him depart. But she says, if your husband is willing to stay married that the husband might be converted by the behavior and conversation of the wife, or vice versa. But that was sort of a second clause where Paul said, in the event that you've got two pagans, that one of them converts, and the pagan spouse says, well, I'm leaving, does that mean now the person who's newly converted can never remarry? No. Paul says they're not under bondage in such cases. So I just want to make sure that people understand that was a specific scenario that Paul is talking about there. If people marry and divorce, is that the unpardonable sin? You remember the story about David and Bathsheba? Now, that wasn't just adultery. Now, that was murder, which, by the way, is worse than divorce, in case you're wondering. The reason I say that, you know how many people are murdered because someone is wanting to get out of a marriage? And I've often thought, well, just divorce them, don't. There are women who have murdered their husbands because they wanted out of the marriage and they signed them up for life insurance in advance. And we've all heard stories about husbands that murder their wives and then try to cover it up because they wanted out of the marriage or they had someone else they were interested in. That's crazy. Murder is much worse. So, what was I saying? Oh, yeah, David. I was talking about David before I... And if your spouse gets senile, stay with them. They need you. David, he committed murder, committed adultery. And they suffered terribly for that sin. And he repented thoroughly for that sin. You read Psalm 32, read Psalm 51. Spent days on his faces, lost a child to death, part of the judgment, lost actually four children in total because of that sin. It was a terrible sin. Brought great shame on the cause of God. David was forgiven. What do you do now? Uriah's dead. David's with Bathsheba. First, David is judged, and God said, because you have taken Uriah's wife, Bathsheba, the wife of Uriah. After David repented, it says David comforted his wife, Bathsheba. She remained his wife. You know, sometimes you cannot unscramble scrambled eggs. People make mistakes, they divorce, they remarry, and they get out in the world, and then they go through a genuine conversion experience, and can they come back to the Lord and be forgiven? Yes. Doesn't mean things are always going to be the same. But yes, there is. It's not the unpardonable sin. What about that Samaritan woman? You remember what Jesus said? Go call your husband. She said, I don't have a husband. He said, aha, you're right. You don't have a husband. You've had five husbands. You know what her name was? Elizabeth Taylor. No. He said, you've had five husbands, and the one that you have now, you're not even married to. Did Jesus forgive her? Did he reveal to her that he was the Messiah? Did he use her to bring the message to others? And so, and God is merciful. So I always, as a pastor, we try to strike a balance between explaining that marriage is sacred, it's a covenant, you need to stick with it, and at the same time let people know, because it is epidemic, it's not the unpardonable sin and there is redemption. And so I hope I'm able to convey those two themes. Shakespeare said, knit your hearts with an unslipping knot, speaking about marriage. I'd like to encourage you, in spite of all the divorces in our culture, some people do very well. Some people have long and happy marriages. My grandparents got married when my grandma was 16 years old. And she used to, you ask her, she'd say, we didn't love each other. She said, I just married him because I wanted to get out of the house and he could sing. My grandfather, he was a Jewish cantor. He had a great singing voice. And you ever heard of the Gong Show? Any of you remember this TV program called The Gong Show? My grandfather sang on The Gong Show and he won. And if you ever came to visit him for the rest of his life, he would show you the videotape of him winning. I hope I get a copy of that. But she said, oh, we didn't love each other. And I saw my grandparents fight. I saw my grandma chasing my grandfather. I used to always hear them yell. She'd say, you put ketchup on everything I cook. Why do I bother? And just say, you heard all these arguments, and they really did argue quite a bit. She'd yell at him, button your pants, put your teeth in. She said, they were married 72 years. I needed that because my mother was married five times and my father was married five times. And my mother lived with a married man for 20 years while I was growing up. And I used to have to pretend I didn't know his wife. And so with that kind of background, mom and dad, I needed grandma and grandpa. And in spite of all their problems, they stuck it out. Oh, Karen's grandparents, Ed's folks. Very touching. Married. How long were they married? 65. How many years? 75 years? No, more than 65 years. He was 100 years old. Yeah, like 75 years. But they were always afraid that one would go before the other. They both died within 2 hours of each other in the same room. And I was reading, wanting to know who's been married the longest. There's this couple, I think they're still alive in England. You know, once you get over 100, you got to keep checking your facts. They married in Bradford, England, tied the knot in 1925. They're definitely the longest married couple in England, probably the world. His name is Karam Chand, born in a rural village in Punjab in northern India in 1905. And they had a very simple Sikh wedding, and they married young. She, I think, was 12 when they married. Now he's 108, she's 101. They've been married 89 years. And evidently, they're happy. Oh, by the way, they also talk about health and say they eat simply natural foods. So, marriage has to be a covenant where you stick with a person in sickness and in health. I remember hearing about this lady that was at her husband's bedside in the hospital as he was kind of slipping in and out of a coma during what was to be his final illness. And during one of his lucid moments, she was at his side. And he said, honey, she drew close when he was talking. He said, I remember, you've always been at my side. And he said, when I lost my job, you were there. When the business failed, there you were. Said, when I broke my leg, you were there. Said, when I got sick, you were there. He said, you know, dear, I just wanted to tell you, I realized something. She drew close and her eyes were all misty. He said, I think you're bad luck. Oh, come on. The guys think it's funny. This is an equal opportunity sermon. Now, that was just the first point. It's a covenant. Point number two, establish your own private home. I'll read it to you again. Genesis 2:24, therefore a man will leave his father and mother and cleave. It's called leave and cleave. And that word cleave, it actually does come from that an ancient Jewish word where they made glue out of horse hooves or sheep hooves, and it was glue. It means be attached. It says you're to leave. It's important to establish your own home. If you have too much of the in-laws and the outlaws all there when you're trying to establish your family, first couple of years are tough. And you need to have some privacy because you're taking your whole scenario of what life's about and all your experiences and your expectations, and you're bringing them to the marriage. And then your wife is taking her experience and bringing it to the marriage. And Karen and I knew we were going to have some challenges because Karen went to the same school 12 years and then went to Christian college. I went to 14 different schools. She grew up in a Christian family. I grew up in a pagan family. And just the way you think and you communicate and your expectations, we knew there was going to be differences. And it's important that you're able to bring those things together so that you can coalesce your lives without outside interference. And if there are third and fourth parties in the home, and I realize sometimes in some cultures and it can become difficult, but God said, a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave unto his wife. The other thing is, if the man has his father and mother living in the house, he's always comparing his mother's cooking to his wife's cooking. And that may not be good for his relationship with one or the other. Establish your own home. Don't let third parties come between. Spouse should be the best friend. Someone once said that marriage resembles a pair of scissors. They're joined so they can't be separated, often moving in opposite directions, but punishing anyone that comes between them. When I was pastoring one time, had this couple living next door. We were giving them Bible studies. They struggled with drinking. One day, a young girl came pounding on our door and said, my father is killing my mother. And so I didn't know what to do, but I went over and I stood at the door and I'm kind of knocking at the door. And I'm hearing things banging and lamps falling over and crashing and yelling and screaming inside. And I thought, well, this isn't going to work. And so without them opening the door, I just went into their house. Feels really strange doing that, you know. I thought, I'm studying with people. I don't want to call the police on them. So I just went in. And so life wasn't long before I could track where all the commotion was coming from. Went off and they're back in the bedroom and she's cowering in the corner and he's ranting. He's been drinking and he's ranting at her and she's screaming at him. And you brought the preacher in here to help you. Something like that. Then he started trying to throw something and I got between him. And next thing I knew, she saw that she had some protection through me. She got up and she started going after him. And pretty soon I was between the two of them. And I started wrestling with him. And I know I'm small, but you know, I had a gold medal in wrestling in military school. I was pretty good. And so I got the guy in a lock. And he couldn't do anything. She started feeling sorry for her husband and started wailing on me. They were killing each other, but when anyone came between them, you better get out of the way. And so I've seen that. No, I'm not recommending what I just said there. I'm just telling you that I've seen it before, that there is a bond in marriage that even when someone comes between them and they're hurting each other, that suddenly she became very defensive about her husband. So you need to establish your own family. Point number three in a marriage, it says, above all things, continue your courtship. What brought you together in the first place needs to go on. 1 Peter 4:8, above all things, be unfailing in your love for one another, since love covers a multitude of sin. You know where Jesus says in Revelation, nevertheless, I have this against you, because what? You've lost your first love. And how many times have people thought, what in the world was I thinking? I love this person. Where'd that love go? We fell out of love. We drifted apart. Well, the things that brought you together in the first place must be continually nurtured and fed and encouraged and revived. Someone said, marriage is like running a farm. You got to start over every day. And you don't really get a day off. Every day you need to nurture it. Every day the cows need milking. Every day I mean, if you have a farm, you don't even do stop that on Sabbath, do you? And so every day there needs to be things that nurture that first love. Proverbs 31:28, her husband praises her. You notice that's an ongoing verb? You continue to encourage and to praise. We need those things. We appreciate it. 1 Corinthians 7:34, she that is married cares how she might please her husband. And so it's an ongoing concern, praise, caring about pleasing this person. When you start taking the person for granted, then you have a lot of problems. You need to show affection. And it needs to be conscious. You might say, well, but I don't feel love. Do it anyway, and you'd be surprised. You might start feeling the love again. Do the first works, Jesus said. Remember from where you have fallen. Repent and do the first works. Romans 12, verse 10. Be kindly affectionate to one another, in honor, preferring one another. Billy Sunday said, try praising your wife, even if it does frighten her at first. And you've heard the expression before, treat her like a queen and she will treat you like a king. And sometimes you will get from the other person what you've always been wanting to get when you treat them the way that they're longing to be treated. And so it's through the cooperative nurturing of each other in the relationship. Don't overlook the little courtesies, encouragements, and affectionate acts. Surprise each other with little things, gifts and favors. I got to think about that because I'm always so work-oriented. You know, Nathan just recently went to, he went to college, yeah, and we were experiencing emptiness. Karen drove him back, and I knew it was going to be tough for her to, you know, wave goodbye. I was actually with some of you on the mission trip when Karen was dropping Nathan off, and she had to come back. And I thought, you know, it's going to be tough for her. Stephen's at college. Nathan's at college. She's going to come home and have to live with me. So I went out and I got a card and I got some flowers and I wrote her a little note and I said, you know, if you're looking for anyone to baby, I'll let you baby me. If it's wasn't that considerate of me to do that? She must have cared because she still got that card on the desk. She stares at it for a while, but when a guy does a little thoughtful thing like that, you need to milk it for all the credit you could get because they don't happen that often. So there needs to be the continued courtship that goes on. Don't take each other for granted. What you did when you courted each other, the excitement, the love, you need to have date nights where you go out and you do things together. And then maybe I'll pause with this thought after I'll do point number four, and we'll take it up when we begin next time. Guard your thoughts. Don't let your senses trap you. Now, you'd be surprised how many marriages are destroyed because of bad thinking. Proverbs 23, verse 7, for as he thinks in his heart, so is he. A lot of adulteries begin with thoughts. You know, one of the number one things that contributes to divorce, it may not be the act of adultery, but it's mental adultery that's happening either through pornography on the internet or soap operas on television. And I'm not saying they're exactly the same thing, but, you know, when every day a wife or a husband, not typically the husband, is watching other people vicariously having affairs, then you're rejoicing in those that do it. It's something that's happening in the thinking. And what's happening is people looking at these unreal images on the internet, on TV, on their computer, or television programs that are giving a counterfeit Hollywood version of what marriage is supposed to be, and totally unrealistic, sappy love stories that are so far-fetched from any real life that people can start to be dissatisfied and think, yeah, they got this some debonair actor that's just, oh, he's the most thoughtful guy in the world, and he's doing all these things. He's so romantic, and he's got lots of money and fancy cars, and he always looks buff and working out, and it's just every hair is in place. And how can you compete with that? And then she, you know, then you come home from work, and she looks at you and goes, oh, brother, he doesn't look anything like that guy. And so in the mind, the lady or the guy Guys are looking at these girls, they got these perfect bodies, airbrushed, Photoshop. And then they see, you know, a couple of wrinkles and a little cellulite. And they start thinking, and things start happening in the mind. Now, we're kind of laughing because we know it's true. But television has contributed a great deal to destroying marriages. Let me read something to you here, if I can find it real quick. Turn off the TV. In an article by Dr. Arnold Nicola, who is a psychiatrist and a medical doctor on the facility of Harvard Medical School, he said, quote, "Another trend that is going to destroy the family as we know it and cause emotional cripples is the invasion of television into the home. One-fifth of the lifetime in the next generation will be spent watching television. If you live to be 80 years of age, which is your average, you'll have watched television a total of 4,000 days, creating a tremendous impact. And since we know that television is part of a system that tears down the family, you'll have a total of 4,000 days of anti-family programming on one level or another." And so everything from what we read to what we watch and what's on the internet, it is affecting the thinking, and people bring these unrealistic expectations into real marriages. They bring these unrealistic images into real marriages, and they are dissatisfied. And then thoughts come into the mind, and they start having second thoughts, and they start having doubts, and they have unrealistic expectations and the impurity in the mind. Keep your mind, keep your heart. Let the Bible and the Word of God and the things of God be the catalyst for your family, and you'll find that that love and appreciation for that person that God has for you, that you've become one with through marriage, will be restored and revived. A couple was, they were having daily bickering arguments, often over little things. They realized that every day they were at each other. And the wife came up with an idea. She said, look, you know, this is silly, it's immature. If we have differences, if there's things we want to communicate, let's give each other a break. If there's something I'm doing that's bothering you, write it out on a slip of paper, put it in this box here on the kitchen counter. If I've got something, I'll write it down, I'll put it in the kitchen counter. At the end of a month, then we'll talk through it, we'll have one big argument and get it over with. So I said, okay, dear. So each day, she'd make an observation, she'd write it down, she'd put it in the box, wouldn't say anything. He'd write something down, he'd put it in the box, wouldn't say anything. This went on for 30 days. At the end of 30 days, she said, okay, let's sit down, let's open the box. She took out the box and she pulled out her pink papers. It said, leaving the lid off the jelly jar again. Dirty socks on the floor. And she just was going through her litany of just all these things. And finally said, okay, you can read your blue ones now. He said, I love you. I love you. I love you. And she began to feel a little bad. The things, now by the way, that story can be told either way. Love covers a multitude of sin. You know, we naturally are not lovable. God didn't die for us because we're lovable. It's easy to love the lovable. While we were yet sinners, Christ loved us and died for us. Amen. And if the Lord can love us, and the love of Christ can be shed abroad in our hearts. You know what's the great commandment in the law? Love the Lord with all your heart and love what? Love who? Your neighbor. Who's a closer neighbor than your spouse? It's interesting. The Bible says you need to love your neighbor. It says you need to love your enemy. Someone brought out, it's often because your neighbor becomes your enemy. And if we can't love our spouses, how are we going to love our enemies? How are we going to love our neighbors? That's where it starts. And it's a choice that needs to be made. Now, there's a rule in life. It says there's a simple rule of physics that the closer that two objects come to a common destination, they will invariably come closer to one another. And if Christ is at the middle of your life, if you personally have surrendered your life to Jesus, the closer you are coming to Jesus, and if your spouse is coming closer to Jesus, you will invariably be coming closer together. God is love. And if He is the center of our lives, He will draw our hearts together in our families and our marriages. Do not let the world define what marriage is for you. God has given us a definition. Amen? And our marriages are to be based on that love relationship with God and with each other. And we're going to sing about that. Got a hymn that talks about the love of God. And why don't we stand together? We're going to sing 183, I Will Sing of Jesus' Love.